Black Boy, Disc 6.
In my class was a tall, black, rebellious boy who was bright in his studies and yet utterly fearless in his assertion of himself. He could break the morale of the class at any moment with his clowning, and the teacher never found an adequate way of handling him. It was he who detected my plaguing hunger and suggested to me a way to earn some money. "You can't sit in school all day and not eat," he said. "What am I going to eat?" I asked. "Why don't you do like me?" "What do you do?"
"I sell papers."
"I tried to get a paper route, but they're all full," I said. "I'd like to sell papers because I could read them. I can't find things to read."
"You too?" he asked, laughing.
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"That's why I sell papers. I like to read them, and that's the only way I can get hold of them," he explained.
"Do your parents object to your reading?" I asked.
"Yeah, my old man's a damn crackpot," he said.
"What papers are you selling?"
"It's a paper published in Chicago. It comes out each week, and it has a magazine supplement," he informed me.
"What kind of paper is it?"
"Well, I never read the newspaper. It isn't much. But boy, the magazine supplement. What stories? I'm reading the serial of Zane Grey's Riders of the Purple Sage."
I stared at him in complete disbelief.
"Riders of the Purple Sage?" I exclaimed.
"Yes."
"Do you think I can sell those papers?"
"Sure. I make over 50 cents a week and have stuff to read," he explained. I followed him home, and he gave me a copy of the newspaper and the magazine supplement. The newspaper was thin, ill-edited, and designed to circulate among rural, white Protestant readers.
"Hurry up and start selling them," he urged me. "I'd like to talk to you about the stories."
I promised him that I would order a batch of them that night. I walked home through the deepening twilight, reading, lifting my eyes now and then from the print in order not to collide with strangers. I was absorbed in the tale of a renowned scientist who had rigged up a mystery room made of metal in the basement of his palatial home. Prompted by some obscure motive, he would lure his victims into this room and then throw an electric switch. Slowly, with heart-racking agony, the air would be sucked from the metal room, and his victims would die, turning red, blue, then black. This was what I wanted, tales like this. I hadn't read enough to have developed any taste in reading. Anything that interested me satisfied me. Now, at last, I could have my reading in the home, could have it there with the approval of Granny. She had already given me permission to sell papers. Oh, boy, how lucky it was for me that Granny couldn't read. She had always burned the books I had brought into the house, branding them as worldly. But she would have to tolerate these papers if she was to keep her promise to me. Aunt Addie's opinion didn't count, and she never paid any attention to me anyway. In her eyes, I was dead. I told Granny that I planned to make some money by selling papers, and she agreed, thinking that at last I was becoming a serious, right-thinking boy. That night, I ordered the papers and waited anxiously. The papers arrived, and I scoured the Negro area, slowly building up a string of customers who bought the papers, more because they knew me than from any desire to read. When I returned home at night, I would go to my room and lock the door, and revel in outlandish exploits of outlandish men in faraway, outlandish cities. For the first time in my life, I became aware of the life of the modern world, of vast cities, and I was claimed by it. I loved it. Though they were merely stories, I accepted them as true because I wanted to believe them, because I hungered for a different life, for something new. The cheap pulp tales enlarged my knowledge of the world more than anything I had encountered so far. To me, with my roundhouse, saloon door, and river levee background, They were revolutionary, my gateway to the world. I was happy, and would have continued to sell the newspaper and its magazine supplement indefinitely, had it not been for the racial pride of a friend of the family. He was a tall, quiet, sober, soft-spoken black man, a carpenter by trade. One evening I called at his home with the paper. He gave me a dime, then looked at me oddly.
"You know, son," he said, "I sure like to see you make a little money each week."
"Thank you, sir," I said.
"But tell me, who told you to sell these papers?" he asked.
"Nobody."
"Where do you get them from?"
"Chicago."
"Do you ever read them?"
"Sure. I read the stories in the magazine supplement," I explained, "but I never read the newspaper." He was silent a moment.
"Did a white man ask you to sell these papers?" he asked.
"No, sir," I answered, puzzled now.
"Why do you ask?"
"Do your folks know you're selling these papers?"
"Yes, sir, but what's wrong?"
"How did you know where to write for these papers?" he asked, ignoring my questions.
"A friend of mine sells them. He gave me the address."
"Is this friend of yours a white man?"
"No, sir, he's colored. But why are you asking me all this?"
He didn't answer. He was sitting on the steps of his front porch. He rose slowly.
"Wait right here a minute, son," he said. "I want to show you something."
Now, what was wrong? The papers were all right. At least they seemed so to me. I waited, annoyed, eager to be gone on my rounds so that I could have time to get home and lie in bed and read the next installment of a thrilling horror story. The man returned with a carefully folded copy of the newspaper. He handed it to me.
"Did you see this?"
he asked, pointing to a lurid cartoon.
"No, sir," I said. "I don't read the newspaper. I only read the magazine."
"Well, just look at that. Take your time and tell me what you think," he said.
It was the previous week's issue, and I looked at the picture of a huge black man with a greasy, sweaty face, thick lips, flat nose, golden teeth, sitting at a polished, wide-top desk in a swivel chair. The man had on a pair of gleaming yellow shoes, and his feet were propped upon the desk. His thick lips nursed a big black cigar that held white ashes an inch long. In the man's red-dotted tie was a dazzling horseshoe stick pin, glaring conspicuously. The man wore red suspenders, and his shirt was striped silk, and there were huge diamond rings on his fat black fingers. A chain of gold girded his belly, and from the fob of his watch, a rabbit's foot dangled. On the floor, at the side of the desk, was a spittoon overflowing with mucus. Across the wall of the room in which the man sat was a bold sign reading, "The White House." Under the sign was a portrait of Abraham Lincoln, the features distorted, to make the face look like that of a gangster. My eyes went to the top of the cartoon, and I read, "The only dream of a nigger is to be president and to sleep with white women. Americans, do we want this in our fair land? Organize and save white womanhood." I stared, trying to grasp the point of the picture and the captions, wondering why it all seemed so strange and yet familiar.
"Do you know what this means?" the man asked me.
"Gee, I don't know," I confessed.
"Did you ever hear of the Ku Klux Klan?" he asked me softly.
"Sure, why?"
"Do you know what the Ku Kluxes do to colored people?"
"They kill us."
They keep us from voting and getting good jobs, I said.
Well, the paper you're selling preaches the Ku Klux Klan doctrines, he said.
Oh, no, I exclaimed.
Son, you're holding it in your hands, he said.
I read the magazine, but I never read the paper, I said vaguely, thoroughly rattled.
Listen, son, he said. Listen, you're a black boy, and you're trying to make a few pennies, all right. I don't want to stop you from selling these papers if you want to sell them, but I've read these papers now for 2 months, and I know what they're trying to do. If you sell them, you're just helping white people to kill you.
But these papers come from Chicago, I protested naively, feeling unsure of the entire world now, feeling that racial propaganda surely could not be published in Chicago, the city to which Negroes were fleeing by the thousands.
I don't care where the paper comes from, he said. Just you listen to this.
He read aloud a long article in which lynching was passionately advocated as a solution for the problem of the Negro. Even though I heard him reading it, I couldn't believe it.
Let me see that, I said.
I took the paper from him and sat on the edge of the steps. In the paling light, I turned the pages and read articles so brutally anti-Negro that goose pimples broke out over my skin.
Do you like that? He asked me.
No, sir, I breathed.
Do you see what you're doing?
I didn't know, I mumbled.
Are you going to sell those papers now?
No, sir, never again.
They tell me that you're smart in school. When I read those papers you were selling, I didn't know what to make of it. Then I said to myself that that boy doesn't know what he's selling. Now, a lot of folks wanted to speak to you about these papers, but they were scared. They thought you were mixed up with some white Ku Kluxers, and if they told you to stop, you would put the Kluxers on them. But I said, shucks, that boy just don't know what he's doing.
I handed him his dime, but he would not take it.
Keep the dime, son, he said. But for God's sake, find something else to sell.
I didn't try to sell any more of the papers that night. I walked home with them under my arm, feeling that some Negro would leap from a bush or fence and waylay me. How on earth could I have made so grave a mistake? The way I had erred was simple, but utterly unbelievable. I had been so enthralled by reading the serial stories in the magazine supplement that I hadn't read a single issue of the newspaper. I decided to keep my misadventure a secret, that I would tell no one that I had been unwittingly an agent for pro-Ku Klux Klan literature. I tossed the papers into a ditch, and when I reached home, I told Granny in a quiet, offhand way that the company didn't want to send me any more papers because they already had too many agents in Jackson, a lie which I thought was an understatement of the actual truth. Granny didn't care one way or the other, since I had been making so little money in selling them that I hadn't been able to help much with household expenses. The father of the boy, who had urged me to sell the papers, also found out their propagandistic nature and forbade his son to sell them. But the boy and I never discussed the subject. We were too ashamed of ourselves. One day he asked me guardedly,
"Say, are you still selling those papers?"
"Oh, no, I don't have time," I said, my eyes avoiding his.
"I'm not either," he said, pulling down the corners of his mouth. "I'm too busy."
I burned at my studies. At the beginning of the school term, I read my civics and English and geography volumes through, and only referred to them when in class. I solved all my mathematical problems far in advance. Then, during school hours, when I wasn't called on to recite. I read tattered second-hand copies of Flynn's Detective Weekly, or the Argosy All-Story magazine, or dreamed, weaving fantasies about cities I had never seen and about people I had never met. School ended. I couldn't get a job that would let me rest on Granny's Holy Sabbath. The long, hot, idle summer days palled on me. I sat at home brooding, nursing bodily and spiritual hunger. In the afternoons, after the sun had spent its force, I played ball with the neighborhood boys. At night I sat on the front steps and stared blankly at the passing people, wagons, cars. On one such lazy, hot summer night, Granny, my mother, and Aunt Addie were sitting on the front porch, arguing some obscure point of religious doctrine. I sat huddled on the steps, my cheeks resting sullenly in my palms, half listening to what the grown-ups were saying, and half lost in a daydream. Suddenly, the dispute evoked an idea in me, and forgetting that I had no right to speak without permission, I piped up and had my say. I must have sounded reekingly blasphemous, for Granny said, "Shut up, you!" and leaned forward promptly to chastise me with one of her casual, backhanded slaps on my mouth. But I had by now become adept at dodging blows, and I nimbly ducked my head. She missed me. The force of her blow was so strong that she fell down the steps, headlong, her aged body wedged in a narrow space between the fence and the bottom step. I leaped up. Aunt Addie and my mother screamed and rushed down the steps and tried to pull Granny's body out, but they couldn't move her. Grandpa was called, and he had to tear the fence down to rescue Granny. She was barely conscious. They put her to bed and summoned a doctor. I was frightened. I ran to my room and locked the door, fearing that Grandpa would rend me to pieces. Had I done right, or had I done wrong? If I had held still and let Granny slap me, she wouldn't have fallen. But was it not natural to dodge a blow? I waited, trembling, but no one came to my room. The house was quiet. Was Granny dead? Hours later, I unlocked the door and crept downstairs. Well, I told myself, if Granny died, I would leave home. There was nothing else to do. Aunt Addie confronted me in the hallway with burning black eyes. "You see what you've done to Granny," she said. "I didn't touch her," I said. I had wanted to ask how Granny was, but my fear made me forget that. "You were trying to kill her," Aunt Addie said. "I didn't touch Granny, and you know it. You are evil. You bring nothing but trouble. I was trying to dodge her. She was trying to hit me. I'd done nothing wrong."
Her lips moved silently as she sought to formulate words to place me in a position of guilt.
"Why do you butt in when grown people are talking?" she demanded, finding her weapon at last.
"I just wanted to talk," I mumbled sullenly. "I sit in this house for hours, and I can't even talk."
"Hereafter, you keep your mouth shut until you're spoken to," she advised me. "But Granny oughtn't always be hitting at me like that," I said as delicately as possible. "Boy, don't you stand there and say what Granny ought to do," she blazed, finding her ground of accusation. "If you don't keep your mouth shut, then I'll hit you," she continued.
"I'm only trying to explain why Granny fell," I said.
"Shut up now, or I'll wring your neck, you fool."
"You're another fool," I came back at her, angry now. She trembled with fury.
"I'll fix you this night," she said, rushing at me.
I dodged her and ran into the kitchen and grabbed the long bread knife. She followed me, and I confronted her. I was so hysterical that I was crying.
"If you touch me, I'll cut you, so help me," I said in gasps. "I'm going to leave here as soon as I can work and make a living, but as long as I'm here, you better not touch me."
We stood looking into each other's eyes, our bodies trembling with hate.
I'm going to get you for this, she vowed in a low, serious voice. I'll get you when you haven't got a knife. I'll always keep a knife for you, I told her. You've got to sleep at night, she whimpered with rage. I'll get you then. If you touch me when I'm sleeping, I'll kill you, I told her.
She walked out of the kitchen, kicking the door open before her as she went. Aunt Addie had a habit of kicking doors. She always paused before a partly open door and kicked it open. If the door swung in, she flung it back with her foot, or if the door was shut, she opened it with her hand for an inch or two, then opened it the rest of the way with her foot. She acted as though she wanted to get a glimpse into the room beyond before she entered it, perhaps to see if it contained anything dreadful or unholy. For a month after that, I took a kitchen knife to bed with me each night, hiding it under my pillow so that when Aunt Addie came, I could protect myself. But she never came. Perhaps she prayed. Granny was abed for 6 weeks. She had wrenched her back when her slap missed me. There were more violent quarrels in our deeply religious home than in the home of a gangster, a burglar, or a prostitute, a fact which I used to hint gently to Granny and which did my cause no good. Granny bore the standard for God, but she was always fighting. The peace that passes understanding never dwelt with us. I, too, fought. But I fought because I felt I had to keep from being crushed, to fend off continuous attack. But Granny and Aunt Addie quarreled and fought not only with me, but with each other, over minor points of religious doctrine, or over some imagined infraction of what they chose to call their moral code. Wherever I found religion in my life, I found strife, the attempt of one individual or group to rule another in the name of God. The naked will to power seemed always to walk in the wake of a hymn. As summer waned, I obtained a strange job. Our next-door neighbor, a janitor, decided to change his profession and become an insurance agent. He was handicapped by illiteracy, and he offered me the job of accompanying him on trips into the Delta plantation area to write and figure for him at wages of $5 a week. I made several trips with Brother Mance, as he was called, to plantation shacks, sleeping on shuck mattresses, eating salt pork and black-eyed peas for breakfast, dinner, and supper, and drinking, for once, all the milk I wanted. I had all but forgotten that I had been born on a plantation, and I was astonished at the ignorance of the children I met. I had been pitying myself for not having books to read, and now I saw children who had never read a book. Their chronic shyness made me seem bold and city-wise. A black mother would try to lure her brood into the room to shake hands with me, and they would linger at the door jamb, peering at me with one eye, giggling hysterically. At night, seated at a crude table with a kerosene lamp spluttering at my elbow, I would fill out insurance applications, and a sharecropper family, fresh from laboring in the fields, would stand and gape. Brother Mance would pace the floor, extolling my abilities with pen and paper. Many of the naive black families bought their insurance from us because they felt that they were connecting themselves with something that would make their children write and speak like that pretty boy from Jackson. The trips were hard. Riding trains, autos, or buggies, moving from morning till night, we went from shack to shack, plantation to plantation. Exhausted, I filled out applications. I saw a bare, bleak pool of black life, and I hated it. The people were alike, their homes were alike, and their farms were alike. On Sundays, Brother Mance would go to the nearest country church and give his sales talk, preaching it in the form of a sermon, clapping his hands as he did so, spitting on the floor to mark off his paragraphs, and stomping his feet in the spit to punctuate his sentences, all of which captivated the black sharecroppers. After the performance, the wall-eyed yokels would flock to Brother Mance, and I would fill out applications until my fingers ached. I returned home with a pocket full of money that melted into the bottomless hunger of the household. My mother was proud. Even Aunt Addie's hostility melted temporarily. To Granny, I had accomplished a miracle, and some of my sinful qualities evaporated, for she felt that success spelled the reward of righteousness, and that failure was the wages of sin. But God called Brother Mance to heaven that winter, and since the insurance company would not accept a minor as an agent, my status reverted to a worldly one. The holy household was still burdened with a wayward boy, to whom, in spite of all, sin somehow insisted upon clinging. School opened, and I began the seventh grade. My old hunger was still with me, and I lived on what I didn't eat. Perhaps the sunshine, the fresh air, and the pot liquor from Greens kept me going. Of an evening, I would sit in my room reading, and suddenly I would become aware of smelling meat frying in a neighbor's kitchen, and would wonder what it was like to eat as much meat as one wanted. My mind would drift into a fantasy, and I would imagine myself a son in a family that had meat on the table at each meal. Then I would become disgusted with my futile daydreams, and would rise and shut the window to bar the torturing scent of meat. When I came downstairs one morning and went into the dining room for my bowl of mush and lard gravy, I felt at once that something serious was happening in the family. Grandpa, as usual, wasn't at the table. He always had his meals in his room. Granny nodded me to my seat. I sat and bowed my head. From under my brows, I saw my mother's tight face. Aunt Addie's eyes were closed, her forehead furrowed, her lips trembling. Granny buried her face in her hands. I wanted to ask what had happened, but I knew that I wouldn't get an answer. Granny prayed and invoked the blessings of God for each of us, asking Him to guide us if it was His will. And then she told God that, "My poor old husband lies sick this beautiful morning," and asked God if it was His will to heal him. That was how I learned of Grandpa's final illness. On many occasions, I learned of some event, a death, a birth, or an impending visit, some happening in the neighborhood, at her church, or at some relative's home, first through Granny's informative prayers at the breakfast or dinner table. Grandpa was a tall, black, lean man with a long face, snow-white teeth, and a head of woolly white hair. In anger, he bared his teeth, a habit, Granny said, that he had formed while fighting in the trenches of the Civil War, and hissed, while his fists would clench until the veins swelled. In his rare laughs, he bared his teeth in the same way, only now his teeth did not flash long, and his body was relaxed. He owned a sharp pocket knife, which I had been forbidden to touch, and sat for long hours in the sun, whittling, whistling quietly, or maybe if he was feeling well, humming some strange tune. I had often tried to ask him about the Civil War, how he had fought, what he had felt. Had he seen Lincoln? But he would never respond. "You get away from me, you young'un," was all that he would ever say. From Granny I learned, over a course of years, that he had been wounded in the Civil War and had never received his disability pension, a fact which he hugged close to his heart with bitterness. I never heard him speak of white people. I think he hated them too much to talk about them. In the process of being discharged from the Union Army, he had gone to a white officer to seek help in filling out his papers. In filling out the papers, the white officer misspelled Grandpa's name, making him Richard Vinson instead of Richard Wilson. It was possible that Grandpa's southern accent and his illiteracy made him mispronounce his own name. It was rumored that the white officer had been a Swede and it had a poor knowledge of English. Another rumor had it that the white officer had been a Southerner and had deliberately falsified Grandpa's papers. Anyway, Grandpa didn't discover that he had been discharged in the name of Richard Vinson until years later, and when he applied to the War Department for a pension, no trace could be found of his ever having served in the Union Army under the name of Richard Wilson. I asked endless questions about Grandpa's pension, but information was always denied me on the grounds that I was too young to know what was involved. For decades, a long correspondence took place between Grandpa and the War Department. In letter after letter, Grandpa would recount events and conversations, always dictating these long accounts to others. He would name persons long dead, citing their ages and descriptions, reconstructing battles in which he had fought, naming towns, rivers, creeks, roads, cities, villages, citing the names and numbers of regiments and companies which he had fought, giving the exact day and the exact hour of the day of certain occurrences, and send it all to the War Department in Washington. I used to get the mail early in the morning, and whenever there was a long, business-like envelope in the stack, I would know that Grandpa had got an answer from the War Department, and I would run upstairs with it. Grandpa would lift his head from the pillow, take the letter from me, and open it himself. He would stare at the black print for a long time, then reluctantly, distrustfully, hand the letter to me. "Well?" he would say. And I would read him the letter, reading slowly and pronouncing each word with extreme care, telling him that his claims for a pension had not been substantiated, and that his application had been rejected. Grandpa would not blink an eye. Then he would curse softly under his breath. "It's them goddamn rebels," he would hiss. As though doubting what I had read, he would dress up and take the letter to at least a dozen of his friends in the neighborhood and ask them to read it to him. Finally, he would know it from memory. At last, he would put the letter away carefully and begin his brooding again, trying to recall out of his past some telling fact that might help him in getting his pension. Like Kay of Kafka's novel The Castle, he tried desperately to persuade the authorities of his true identity, right up to the day of his death, and failed. Often, when there was no food in the house, I would dream of the government sending a letter that would read something like this. "Dear Sir, your claim for a pension has been verified. The matter of your name has been satisfactorily cleared up. In accordance with official regulations, we are hereby instructing the Secretary of the Treasury to compile and compute and send to you, as soon as it is convenient, the total amount of all monies past due, together with interest, for the past blank years, the amount being blank dollars. We regret profoundly that you have been so long delayed in this matter. You may be assured that your sacrifice has been a boon and a solace to your country." But no letter like that ever came. And Grandpa was so sullen most of the time that I stopped dreaming of him and his hopes. Whenever he walked into my presence, I became silent, waiting for him to speak, wondering if he were going to upbraid me for something. I would relax when he left. My will to talk to him gradually died. It was from Granny's conversations, year after year, that the meager details of Grandpa's life came to me. When the Civil War broke out, he ran off from his master and groped his way through the Confederate lines to the north. He darkly boasted of having killed "more'n my fair share of them damn rebels," while en route to enlist in the Union Army. Militantly resentful of slavery, he joined the Union Army to kill Southern whites. He waded in icy streams, slept in mud, suffered, fought. Mustered out, he returned to the South and, during elections, guarded ballot boxes with his army rifle so that Negroes could vote. But when the Negro had been driven from political power, his spirit had been crushed. He was convinced that the war had not really ended, that it would start again. And now, as we ate breakfast, we ate in silence. There was never any talk at our table. Granny said that talking while eating was sinful, that God might make the food choke you. We thought of Grandpa's pension. During the days that followed, letters were written, affidavits were drawn up and sworn to, conferences were held, but nothing came of it all. It was my conviction, supported by no evidence, save my own emotional fear of whites, that Grandpa had been cheated out of his pension because of his opposition to white supremacy. I came in from school one afternoon, and Aunt Addie met me in the hallway. Her face was trembling, and her eyes were red. "Go upstairs and say goodbye to your grandpa," she said. "What's happened?" She didn't answer. I ran upstairs and was met by Uncle Clark, who had come from Greenwood. Granny caught my hand. "Come and say goodbye to your grandpa," she said. She led me to Grandpa's room. He was lying fully dressed upon the bed, looking as well as he ever looked. His eyes were open, but he was so still that I didn't know if he was dead or alive.
"Papa, here's Richard," Granny whispered.
Grandpa looked at me, flashed his white teeth for a fraction of a second. "Goodbye, Grandpa," I whispered.
"Goodbye, son,"
he spoke hoarsely.
"Rejoice, for God has picked out my city in heaven."
His voice died. I hadn't understood what he had said, and I wondered if I should ask him to repeat it. But Granny took my hand and led me from the room. The house was quiet. There was no crying. My mother sat silent in her rocking chair, staring out the window. Now and then she would lower her face to her hands. Granny and Aunt Addie moved silently about the house. I sat mute, waiting for Grandpa to die. I was still puzzled about what he had tried to say to me. It seemed important that I should know his final words. I followed Granny into the kitchen. "Granny, what did Grandpa say? I didn't quite hear him," I whispered. She whirled and gave me one of her backhanded slaps across the mouth.
"Shut up! The angel of death's in the house!"
"I just wanted to know," I said, nursing my bruised lips. She looked at me and relented.
"He said that God had picked out his seat in heaven," she said. "Now you know. So sit down and quit asking fool questions."
When I awakened the next morning, my mother told me that Grandpa had gone home.
"Get on your hat and coat," Granny said.
"What do you want me to do?" I asked.
"Quit asking questions and do what you are told," she said.
I dressed for the outdoors.
"Go to Tom and tell him that Papa's gone home. Ask him to come here and take charge of things," Granny said.
Tom, her eldest son, had recently moved from Hazelhurst to Jackson and lived near the outskirts of town. Feeling that I was bearing an important message, I ran every inch of the 2 miles. I thought that news of a death should be told at once. I came inside of my uncle's house with a heaving chest. I bounded up the steps and rapped on the door. My little cousin Maggie opened the door.
"Where's Uncle Tom?" I asked.
"He's sleeping," she said. I ran into his room, went to his bed, and shook him.
"Uncle Tom, Granny says to come at once. Grandpa's dead," I panted.
He stared at me a long time.
"You certainly are a prize fool," he said quietly.
Don't you know that's no way to tell a person that his father's dead?
I stared at him, baffled, panting. I ran all the way out here, I gasped. I'm out of breath. I'm sorry. He rose slowly and began to dress, ignoring me. He didn't utter a word for 5 minutes.
What are you waiting for? He asked me.
Nothing, I said. I walked home slowly, asking myself what on earth was the matter with me. Why it was, I never seemed to do things as people expected them to be done. Every word and gesture I made seemed to provoke hostility. I had never been able to talk to others, and I had to guess at their meanings and motives. I had not intentionally tried to shock Uncle Tom, and yet his anger at me seemed to outweigh his sorrow for his father. Finding no answer, I told myself that I was a fool to worry about it, that no matter what I did, I would be wrong somehow, as far as my family was concerned. I wasn't allowed to go to Grandpa's funeral. I was ordered to stay home and mind the house. I sat reading detective stories until the family returned from the graveyard. They told me nothing, and I asked no questions. The routine of the house flowed on as usual. For me, there was sleep, mush, greens, school, study, loneliness, yearning, and then sleep again. My clothing became so shabby that I was ashamed to go to school. Many of the boys in my class were wearing their first long pantsuits. I grew so bitter that I decided to have it out with Granny. I would tell her that if she didn't let me work on Saturdays, I would leave home. But when I opened the subject, she wouldn't listen. I followed her about the house, demanding the right to work on Saturday. Her answer was no and no and no. "Then I'll quit school," I declared.
"Quit, Dan. See how much I care," she said.
"I'll go away from here and you'll never hear from me."
"No, you won't," she said tauntingly.
"How can I ever learn enough to get a job?" I asked her, switching my tactics. I showed her my ragged stockings, my patched pants.
"Look, I won't go to school like this. I'm not asking you for money or to do anything. I only want to work."
"I have nothing to do with whether you go to school or not," she said. "You left the church, and you're on your own. You are with the world. You're dead to me, dead to Christ."
"That old church of yours is messing up my life," I said.
"Don't you say that in this house."
"It's true, and you know it."
"God's punishing you," she said, "and you're too proud to ask him for help."
"I'm going to get a job anyway."
"Then you can't live here," she said.
"Then I'll leave," I said, trembling violently.
"You won't leave," she repeated.
"You think I'm joking, don't you?"
I asked, determined to make her know how I felt.
"I'll leave this minute."
I ran to my room, got a battered suitcase, and began packing my ragged clothes. I didn't have a penny, but I was going to leave. She came to the door.
"You little fool, put that suitcase down."
"I'm going where I can work."
She snatched the suitcase out of my hands. She was trembling.
"All right," she said. "If you want to go to hell, then go. But God'll know that it wasn't my fault. He'll forgive me, but he won't forgive you."
Weeping, she rushed from the door. Her humanity had triumphed over her fear. I emptied the suitcase, feeling spent. I hated these emotional outbursts, these tempests of passion, for they always left me tense and weak. Now I was, truly, dead to Granny and Aunt Addie, but my mother smiled when I told her that I had defied them. She rose and hobbled to me on her paralytic legs and kissed me. Chapter 6. The next day at school, I inquired among the students about jobs, and was given the name of a white family who wanted a boy to do chores. That afternoon, as soon as school had let out, I went to the address. A tall, dour woman talked to me. Yes, she needed a boy, an honest boy, $2 a week, mornings, evenings, and all day Saturdays, washing dishes, chopping wood, scrubbing floors, cleaning the yard. I would get my breakfast and dinner. As I asked timid questions, my eyes darted about. What kind of food would I get? Was the place as shabby as the kitchen indicated? "Do you want this job?" the woman asked. "Yes, ma'am," I said, afraid to trust my own judgment. "Now, boy, I want to ask you one question, and I want you to tell me the truth," she said. "Yes, ma'am," I said, all attention. "Do you steal?" she asked me seriously. I burst into a laugh, then checked myself. "What's so damn funny about that?" she asked. "Lady, if I was a thief, I'd never tell anybody." "What do you mean?" she blazed with a red face. I had made a mistake. During my first 5 minutes in the white world, I hung my head. "No, ma'am," I mumbled. "I don't steal." She stared at me, trying to make up her mind. "Now look, we don't want a sassy nigger around here," she said. "No, ma'am," I assured her. "I'm not sassy." Promising to report the next morning at 6 o'clock, I walked home and pondered on what could possibly have been in the woman's mind to have made her ask me point blank if I stole. Then I recalled hearing that white people looked upon Negroes as a variety of children. And it was only in the light of that that her question made any sense. If I had been planning to murder her, I certainly would not have told her. And rationally, she no doubt realized it. Yet habit had overcome her rationality and had made her ask me, "Boy, do you steal?" Only an idiot would have answered, "Yes, ma'am, I steal." What would happen now that I would be among white people for hours at a stretch? Would they hit me? Curse me? If they did, I would leave at once. In all my wishing for a job, I hadn't thought of how I would be treated, and now it loomed important, decisive, sweeping down beneath every other consideration. I would be polite, humble, saying yes, sir, and no, sir, yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, but I would draw a line over which they must not step. Oh, maybe I'm just thinking up trouble, I told myself. They might like me. The next morning, I chopped wood for the cook stove, lugged in scuttles of coal for the grates, washed the front porch, and swept the back porch, swept the kitchen, helped wait on the table, and washed the dishes. I was sweating. I swept the front walk and ran to the store to shop. When I returned, the woman said, "Your breakfast is in the kitchen." "Thank you, ma'am." I saw a plate of thick black molasses and a hunk of white bread on the table. Would I get no more than this? Dade had eggs, bacon, coffee. I picked up the bread and tried to break it. It was stale and hard. Well, I would drink the molasses. I lifted the plate and brought it to my lips. I saw floating on the surface of the black liquid green and white bits of mold. "God damn, I can't eat this," I told myself. The food wasn't even clean. The woman came into the kitchen as I was putting on my coat. "You didn't eat," she said. "No, ma'am," I said. "I'm not hungry." "You'll eat at home?" she asked hopefully. "Well, I just wasn't hungry this morning, ma'am," I lied. "You don't like molasses and bread," she said dramatically. "Oh, yes, ma'am, I do," I defended myself quickly, not wanting her to think that I dared criticize what she had given me. "I don't know what's happening to you niggers nowadays,"
she sighed, wagging her head. She looked closely at the molasses. It's a sin to throw out molasses like that. I'll put it up for you this evening. Yes, ma'am, I said heartily. Neatly, she covered the plate of molasses with another plate, then felt the bread and dumped it into the garbage. She turned to me, her face lit with an idea. What grade are you in school?
Seventh, ma'am.
Then why are you going to school? She asked in surprise.
Well, I want to be a writer, I mumbled, unsure of myself. I hadn't planned to tell her that, but she had made me feel so utterly wrong and of no account that I needed to bolster myself.
A what? She demanded.
A writer, I mumbled.
For what?
To write stories, I mumbled defensively.
You'll never be a writer, she said. Who on earth put such ideas into your nigger head?
Nobody, I said.
I didn't think anybody ever would, she declared indignantly.
As I walked around her house to the street, I knew that I wouldn't go back. The woman had assaulted my ego. She had assumed that she knew my place in life, what I felt, what I ought to be, and I resented it with all my heart. Perhaps she was right. Perhaps I would never be a writer. But I didn't want her to say so. Had I kept the job, I would have learned quickly just how white people acted toward Negroes. But I was too naive to think that there were many white people like that. I told myself that there were good white people, people with money and sensitive feelings. As a whole, I felt that they were bad, but I would be lucky enough to find the exceptions. Fearing that my family might think I was finicky, I lied to them, telling them that the white woman had already hired a boy. At school, I continued to ask about jobs and was directed to another address. As soon as school was out, I made for the house. Yes, the woman said, that she wanted a boy who could milk a cow, feed chickens, gather vegetables, help serve breakfast and dinner.
But I can't milk a cow, ma'am, I said.
Where are you from? She asked incredulously.
Here in Jackson, I said.
You mean to stand there, nigger, and tell me that you live in Jackson and don't know how to milk a cow? She demanded in surprise.
I said nothing, but I was quickly learning the reality, a Negro's reality, of the white world. One woman had assumed that I would tell her if I stole, and now this woman was amazed that I couldn't milk a cow. I, a nigger, who dared live in Jackson. They were all turning out to be alike, differing only in detail. I faced a wall in the woman's mind, a wall that she didn't know was there.
I just never learned, I said finally.
I'll show you how to milk a cow, she said, as though glad to be charitable enough to repair a nigger's knowledge on that score.
It's easy.
The place was large. They had a cow, chickens, a garden, all of which spelled food, and that decided me. I told her that I would take the job, and I reported for work the next morning. My tasks were simple, but many. I milked the cow under her supervision, gathered eggs, swept, and was through in time to serve breakfast. The dining room table was set for five. There were eggs, bacon, toast, jam, butter, milk, apples. That seemed promising. The woman told me to bring the food in as they called for it, and I familiarized myself with the kitchen so that I could act quickly when called upon. Finally, the woman came into the dining room, followed by a pale young man who sat down and stared at the food.
What the hell? He snarled. Every morning it's these damn eggs for breakfast.
Listen, you son of a bitch, the woman said, sitting too. You don't have to eat them.
You might try serving some dirt, he said, and forked up the bacon.
I felt that I was dreaming. Were they like that all the time? If so, I wouldn't stay here. A young girl came and flopped into her chair.
"That's right, you bitch," the young man said. "Knock the food right out of my goddamn mouth."
"You know what you can do," the girl said. I stared at them so intently that I wasn't aware that the young man was watching me.
"Say, what in hell are you glaring at me for, you nigger bastard?" he demanded. "Get those goddamn biscuits off that stove and put them on the table."
"Yes, sir." Two middle-aged men came in and sat down. I never learned who was in the family, who was related to whom, or if it was a family. They cursed each other in an amazingly offhand manner, and nobody seemed to mind. As they hurled invectives, they barely looked at each other. I was tense each moment, trying to anticipate their wishes and avoid a curse, and I didn't suspect that the tension I had begun to feel that morning would lift itself into the passion of my life. Perhaps I had waited too long to start working for white people. Perhaps I should have begun earlier, when I was younger, as most of the other black boys had done. And perhaps by now, the tension would have become an habitual condition, contained and controlled by reflex. But that wasn't to be my lot. I was always to be conscious of it, brood over it, carry it in my heart, live with it, sleep with it, fight with it. The morning was physically tiring, but the nervous strain, the fear that my actions would call down upon my head a storm of curses, was even more damaging. When the time came for me to go to school, I was emotionally spent. But I clung to the job, because I got enough to eat, and no one watched me closely and measured out my food. I had rarely tasted eggs, and I would put hunks of yellow butter into a hot skillet and hurriedly scramble 3 or 4 eggs at a time and gobble them down in huge mouthfuls so that the woman wouldn't see me. And I would take tumblers of milk behind a convenient door and drain them in a swallow as though they contained water. Though the food I ate strengthened my body, I acquired another problem. I had fallen down in my studies at school. Had I been physically stronger, had not my new tension sapped my already limited energy, I might have been able to work mornings and evenings and still carry my studies successfully. But in the middle of the day, I would grow groggy. In the classroom, I would feel that the teacher and the pupils were receding from me, and I would know that I was drifting off to sleep. I would go to the water fountain in the corridor and let cold water run over my wrists, chilling my blood, hoping in that way to keep awake. But the job had its boon. At the midday recess, I would crowd gladly into the corner store and eat sandwiches with the boys, slamming down my own money on the counter for what I wanted, swapping descriptions of the homes of white folks in which we worked. I used to divert them with vivid word pictures of the cursing family, their brooding silences, their indifference toward one another. I told them of the food I managed to eat when the woman's back was turned, and they were filled with friendly envy. The boys would now examine some new article of clothing I had bought. None of us allowed a week to pass without buying something new, paying 50 cents down and 50 cents per week. We knew that we were being cheated, but we never had enough cash to buy in any other way. My mother began a rapid recovery. I was happy when she expressed the hope that someday soon we might have a home of our own. Though Granny was angry and disgusted, my mother began to attend a Methodist church in the neighborhood, and I went to Sunday school, not because my mother begged me to, which she did, but to meet and talk with my classmates. In the black Protestant church, I entered a new world. Prim, brown, puritanical girls who taught in the public schools, black college students who tried to conceal their plantation origin, black boys and girls emerging self-consciously from adolescence, wobbly-bosomed black and yellow church matrons, black janitors and porters who sang proudly in the choir, subdued redcaps and carpenters who served as deacons, meek, blank-eyed, black and yellow washerwomen who shouted and moaned and danced when hymns were sung. Jovial, pot-bellied black bishops, skinny old maids who were constantly giving rallies to raise money. Snobbery, clannishness, gossip, intrigue, petty class rivalry, and conspicuous displays of cheap clothing. I liked it, and I did not like it. I longed to be among them, yet when with them, I looked at them as if I were a million miles away. I had been kept out of their world too long ever to be able to become a real part of it. Nevertheless, I was so starved for association with people that I allowed myself to be seduced by it all, and for a few months I lived the life of an optimist. A revival began at the church, and my classmates at school urged me to attend. More because I liked them than from any interest in religion, I consented. As the services progressed night after night, my mother tried to persuade me to join, to save my soul at last, to become a member of a responsible community church. Despite the fact that I told them I could never feel any religion, the boys of my gang begged me to come to God. "You believe in God, don't you?" they asked. I evaded the question. "But this is a new day," they said, pulling down the corners of their lips. "We don't holler and moan in church no more. Come to church and be a member of the community." "Oh, I don't know," I said. "We don't want to push you," they said delicately, implying that if I wanted to associate with them, I would have to join.
This ends Disc 6.